Welcome to another episode of Always Bev, The Ripple Effect. I am your host, Barb Jordan.
And I said, nobody's seen Josh and Susan. As far as I know, I'm the last one who saw them walking home from church with Susan at noon. I was horrified to see things like, if I die, it may not be an accident. That to him, the kids were just another possession. And that if he couldn't have them, then nobody could.
Josh Powell was an evil man, and his father, Stephen, may have been more evil. Details emerged about Josh from his childhood that we feel certain Susan did not know about when she got engaged. Through research and articles and other podcasts, it appears that Josh had a dark childhood. It's reported that he killed gerbils when he was younger. He tackled his sister on the front lawn in a moment of anger. And his parents were divorced. And when Terry Powell divorced Steve Powell, she talked about how he was damaging her children's respect for marriage. Steve Powell taught his sons about birth control when they were just 9, and he showed them books about sexual intercourse when they were only 6 and 8 years old. And when Josh's brother had a girlfriend growing up, Josh is quoted as saying, "All she is good for is her body." Right, Dad? This episode will close with what happened to the males in the Powell family. This is the second episode discussing Susan Powell and Josh Powell, and we are joined again by her best friend, Kiersey Helliwell. And I have to tell you, we should all have a best friend like Kiersey. She has spent years sharing Susan's story. Kiersey, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You stated that you last saw Susan walking home from church with Josh on a Sunday morning. The following day, on a Monday morning, you get a phone call that Susan is missing. What was your first thought?
Well, I was sitting there it was Monday morning, December 7th, 2009, and I homeschool my 3 kids. And so I was sitting there doing school with them. My phone rang and I looked at it. And I saw Jennifer Graves. And for a second, I thought, who is that? And then I remembered, oh, I think this is Josh's sister. I've only met her once at Susan's baby shower that we had at my house. And I answered it. And she said, this is Jennifer Graves, Josh's sister. When is the last time that you saw Susan and Josh and the kids? And I said, what? Are they okay? What's going on? And she said, I don't know. They're not at work. They're not at their house. And we can't find them and everybody's worried. And so I put on all my warm clothes because we just had some fresh snow the night before and walked over to her house. And when I got there, they already had police there and they had already broken a window to get inside and found out that nobody was in there because there were no tracks in the snow. And so we thought maybe they had carbon monoxide poisoning and they were all unconscious or dead in their beds. And so Jennifer asked the police to break a window. And they got inside and found nobody there. And the van was gone.
So when you say there were no tracks, there was no car tracks coming out of the driveway because it had snowed that night before.
Yep. It had snowed on Sunday night at some point. It wasn't snowing when I went to bed around 10 o'clock or so, but it had snowed by the time we woke up the next morning. And so there were no car tracks in the fresh snow. And we just thought, well, maybe they're all dead inside the house. And nobody was there. And Jennifer, Josh's sister, noticed Susan's keys and purse and wallet sitting there in plain view in the house, and the van gone and all of them gone. And she thought that was so weird because she knew that Susan would never leave without her purse, their wallet and keys and all that stuff.
Once the police broke the window, did you get to go in or just the sister?
No, I didn't go in. Okay. I just stayed outside, hoping that they would show up, that something would happen. And then I started going door to door, knocking on all the neighbors' doors and saying, when did you guys last see Susan and Josh? When did you last see Susan and Josh?
What else was weird inside the house when they went in?
And this is just, secondhand information, but it's in the police report that there were 2 box fans blowing on the carpet and some kind of water or something that was wet on the carpet and the couch.
And did they tell you that, like when they came outside, did anyone tell you, or was this later on you learned about that?
I can't remember. I'm sure Jennifer must have told me because we had so many frantic phone calls back and forth and in trying to figure out what was going on. But I can't remember exactly when I heard.
You're knocking on everybody's door. Everyone's trying to figure out who saw Susan last. And it comes out, you find out that somebody was at their house the night before.
I started calling our church congregation friends. I started calling people. I was knocking on doors and I got a new friend, Giovanna, on the phone, and she had recently moved to the area. And I said, nobody's seen Josh and Susan. As far as I know, I'm the last one who saw them walking home from church with Susan at noon on Sunday. And she said, oh, actually, I was at their house all afternoon yesterday.
And that night, Josh decided to make them dinner. Is that correct?
Yeah, Susan knew that Giovanna had a special, a talent for untangling snarled up balls of yarn. That kind of thing drives me crazy, and I'll try for 5 minutes because we all loved crocheting. Susan and Giovanna and I loved crocheting and knitting. And I would try for 5 minutes and then just give up and cut the yarn. But Giovanna just would sit there for hours and just patiently untangle this whole ball. So Susan called up Giovanna on Sunday afternoon and she said, I'm making a blanket for Brayden, her youngest son, and the yarn's all snarled up. Would you be willing to come over and fix it for me? And then Giovanna heard Josh say in the background, oh, tell her that she can stay for dinner. I'm making pancakes. And at the time, Giovanna was such a new friend. She'd only moved there a few weeks earlier. She didn't know that this was completely unusual for Josh to do anything whatsoever for Susan. He never cooked. He never made food for her. And he especially never invited people over to eat any of their food because he was at that point very stingy and selfish about any of their food and was like, oh, no. They would eat too much. We're not inviting anyone over, even though he was happy to go to anyone's house and eat their food. So Giovanna didn't know this. And I now think that Josh specifically chose her to be a witness to how kind and how nice he was being and to prove that his pancakes were fine because she ate them too.
My next question.
Because Giovanna didn't know them well enough to know that any of this was strange or unusual behavior from Josh.
Right. In a report that I read, it said that Josh was on the phone with his father getting a specific recipe on how to make pancakes. And when he made the pancakes, he didn't put more than one in a frying pan. He actually made them one at a time and then put those pancakes on a plate and brought them to the specific people in the house.
Yeah, I don't know how he made them because the girl, Susan and Giovanna, weren't in the kitchen with him, but he did bring them their food. He had the boys at the kitchen table, and then he had Susan and Giovanna on the couch, and he brought them their plates individually and made up and handed Giovanna her plate and Susan her plate.
And did Susan get sick after she ate the pancakes?
Giovanna says that she just suddenly felt really tired. And she said, I'm really, really tired. I'm going to go take a nap, I think. And Giovanna said, oh, that's fine. I can just sit here and work on this yarn. And as soon as I finish it, I'll leave it here and I'll be taking off. And within a few minutes, Josh was kind of saying, well, you can just take it with you because I'm going to take the boys sledding. So you can just take it, and basically kicking her out. And so she left at around 5 o'clock on Sunday. And she saw Josh and the boys pulling out in the van when she left.
And that was the last time anybody saw Susan alive.
Yep.
So we're going to go back to the evening. They've been missing all day long. And Josh and the boys come home.
So this was Monday, December 7th of 2009. And as the hours went by, I got more and more worried. And so did everyone who loved them, their family. And I got a phone call from somebody, I think it was one of their neighbors, I can't remember now, telling me that they're back. And I was like, oh, are they okay? Well, it's just Josh and the boys. And I said, where's Susan? And they said, nobody knows, she wasn't with them. And so immediately, as soon as I heard that, I just thought, what has he done? And I never would have thought that he would have hurt her before that. In fact, I once asked Susan, do you think he would ever try to hurt you? Has he ever tried to hit you? And she said, no, he hasn't. I know now that that's not true. They had at least one fight where they hit each other. But she said, And then she said, oh, I could take him. I work out. I'm much more buff than he is. And so I'm not worried. But at that time, until I heard that he was back with the boys and Susan wasn't with him, I'd never thought he was actually going to do something to her.
And so his story is that Susan was, they watched a movie, the family watched a movie, and that Susan went to sleep and he took the boys on a camping trip. But as you mentioned, it was snowing. It was blizzard-like conditions. Would Susan have ever let him take two young boys, 4 years and younger, correct?
Yep. They were 2 and 4 at the time.
On a camping trip in the middle of the night in a blizzard. What mom would ever let the husband do that?
No, she never would have. And in fact, he tried to take them out to the desert on a camping trip in March of 2009. So several months earlier, more when it was spring. And even then it was too cold. And they came back in the middle of the night crying. The boys were crying and saying they were cold. So he gave up and came back in the middle of the night. So I know that he would never have let her do that. She never would have been okay with it. She knew that he had to go to work the next day, that the boys had daycare the next day. And she just never would have ever let that happen.
So very quickly, you already know none of this is adding up. Already know that.
I knew immediately that he had done something terrible to her and that he was completely lying.
Did you ever have the chance to talk to him one-on-one? Did you ever have the chance to say to him, where's Susan?
I did. And I felt like I had to be very careful because I thought if I come out as accusatory and attacking him, all avenues of communication are going to be completely cut off and he'll never talk to me again because he'd done that to anyone else who had treated him that way. But if I pretend to be his friend and pretend to be sympathetic and pretend that I want to help him, then maybe he'll let something slip that would help us find her. And I'm just desperate. So I'm going to try to be kind and nice, even though I know that he probably murdered her. And so we helped him when we could. Like he asked us if he could. He moved to Washington just a few days, less than 2 weeks after she disappeared, which is a huge, huge guilty flag in my mind. Instead of staying and helping look for her and begging the public to help, he left. But he would come back to Utah in 2010, several times in 2011 to take care of his house or to do other things. And so he would ask my husband to pick him up at the airport, or he would ask if he could use our computer to make a lease agreement for renting his house out. Or he would say, I didn't bring any blankets or pillows and borrow those from us, things like that. And so there was one time when I emailed the lead detective on the case and I said, because of course I was passing along every single thing that he would say or do and when he was coming and when he was leaving, anything I could to help the police. And I asked the lead detective, should I stage a hysterical crying show and just to be sobbing mess and ask Josh, where is she? Where could she be? Where could she be? Because that way I'll look like I'm heartbroken, because I was. It was hard to keep from doing nothing but crying when she disappeared all those weeks and months. And the detective told me, I don't think it'll do any good, but you're welcome to try. And so I did. And it was not hard at all to muster up the tears that are always under the surface. And just I was sobbing and stared at Josh. And I said, Josh, please, where could she be? Where could she be? I've looked so hard. I've tried so hard. I've done everything I can think of. Where could she be? And he got tears in his eyes too, which surprised me. And he just looked at the floor and just mumbled, I don't know. And that's all he would say.
Did you ever see the videotape of him being questioned by the detectives immediately after she disappeared and where he was emotional and almost crying? And then when he flips the switch and he goes completely into non-urgency, into, I don't know anything. Have you ever seen that?
I have seen it. And if I'm remembering right, it seemed like he was kind of a different personality with the different detectives. So he was crying and emotional with one and then not with the other one.
Have you ever seen him flip a switch like that when you, in any of your encounters with you and your family, or just when you were with him and Susan, had you ever seen him change personalities like that?
Nope, never. He was pretty loud and talkative and mostly not too emotional when he was around us, except if he would get angry. And then after she disappeared, he was very quiet and wouldn't talk.
Did Susan ever tell you that he took out a life insurance policy on her?
She did tell me that. She asked, she called me up and she said, Josh and I are at a lawyer's office right now, setting up a trust. She called it a trust. She didn't call it a life insurance. She said, we're setting up a trust and it's taking longer than it should because Josh is asking the lawyer, I want you to do this, I want you to do that. And the lawyer's saying, no, that's illegal. No, I can't. No, that's illegal. And so it's taking forever, like everything with Josh does. So can you go and pick up the boys from daycare for me? And I said, sure, that's fine. But I do have a meeting in like an hour. So if you're not done by then we're going to have to figure something else out. So I went and picked up the boys from their daycare provider, Debbie Caldwell, who was like a grandma to those boys. She loved them and she loved Susan. And that was the first and only time I had ever met Debbie before Susan disappeared. And now we're really good friends. But that was the only time that she mentioned it.
Was there a life insurance policy on Josh?
Yes, there was. I think it was, if I'm remembering right, $1 million on each Susan and Josh and 500,000 on each of the kids.
All right. So they go missing. Josh moves home to be with his father. So he moves back to Washington. Immediately he leaves. And even on the days after, he cleaned out his house, he cleaned his car. And in fact, when the cops searched the van, they actually found Susan's phone in the car. What did you think when you heard that news?
I didn't hear that until long after everything happened. But it was pretty horrifying to hear that her phone was in the car and the SIM card was removed. So why would he have her phone, especially if her purse was left at her house? And why would the SIM card be taken out? Just another guilty flag.
And when the boys were interviewed, and obviously they were very gentle with them, with the child therapists, and one of the boys said, we all went camping, but mommy didn't come home. Something to that effect. Did you see that video?
Yeah. Well, long after, years and years later, when it finally got released, probably with the Cold podcast, I don't think I'd seen it until then.
Yeah. So there's a lot of things pointing to Josh and all of your weird behavior that he had in the years prior. This was just like a boiling pot of hot water that got hotter and hotter and hotter. And then one day he made a plan to take her away. Is that how you look at it?
Yes. And it's funny because all of her friends had little pieces of what was going on, but none of us had all of it. And if we had all known each other and been able to put together everything that she told us, maybe we could have helped her get out sooner. But I said to her once, you've been in this for so long and it's come on to you so gradually, his control, that it's like you've been in a pot of cold water and it's been gradually getting hotter and hotter. Because when you first moved here, if I had said to you, within a couple of years, Josh is going to be telling you what you can and can't buy at the store. He's going to be telling you that you have to give him control of your bank account, and he's going to sell your car, make you ride your bike to work, all these things. You would have said, no way, he would never treat me that way. And now you don't even realize how bad it's gotten. And I do think that he was going to get rid of her in early 2009 when they took a trip to Washington. They went to visit their families and he said to Susan, I want to have a little romantic weekend getaway. Let's go camping and we'll leave the boys with my dad. And she felt super uncomfortable about that because as much as she wanted to think, well, maybe he's changing, maybe he's going to start caring about me again and wanting to spend time with me, she just couldn't stand the thought of her boys being with his disgusting father. And so she said, well, let's leave them with my parents. No. They have to be with my dad. And she said, no, okay, well, I'm not going then. And I think that he had planned it even back then, that he thought, well, I've got this life insurance on her. We can go on this camping trip and my dad will have the boys. So her parents can't get their hands on them and everything will be perfect. All I have to do is push her off a cliff and, oh, it was an accident. My wife slipped, help me find her. And he'll have this great life with his one annoying part of his life that's keeping him from doing what he wants gone. But she wouldn't go. And so he had to put a plan into motion for later.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good insight on your part for sure. And you actually had very good insight on him all along. He never fooled you. He never fooled you.
Well, I sure didn't think he would ever really hurt her or kill her. If I had known about the document that she wrote and called her last will and testament. If I had known about that, I hope that I would have gone to her house with police and stood there while she packed suitcases for her and the boys and gotten her out. Yeah. But in the end, it was her choice. I couldn't force her to do anything. All I could do was help her in every possible way, pray for her and be there to listen, because I couldn't make her do anything.
Because she put her boys before herself.
She did. She wanted them to be safe more than anything. She would have given her life for them.
And in that video that the attorney made her or advised her to make and that she hid, what's the last sentence she says in there on that video?
Something like, I hope everything will be fine, and I hope it'll be, turn out okay, and we'll be happy as much as it's possible to be.
When the attorney recommended to her, to Susan, to make a video, she did, and she films herself. And one of the last things that I saw in the video was that she said something like, if I go missing, don't think that it's an accident. Do you remember that at all?
I don't remember that in the video, but that was in a letter in her last will and testament letter that she wrote and kept in a safe deposit box.
So on the video, that's one thing. So she had a safety deposit box that Josh did not know about. And in it, she wrote a last will and testament. What was one of the most remembering things on there that stood out to you the most that she wrote?
I did not learn about that letter until long after she disappeared. She didn't tell me, and I don't, for a long time, I struggled to figure out why she didn't tell me. And then I thought maybe it was because she probably knew that I would stand there and insist she leave immediately. But when I heard about it and got to see the contents of the letter or the will later on, I was horrified to see things like, if I die, it may not be an accident. And on the front, she wrote, for friends and family of Susan, not Josh Powell, husband, I don't trust him.
Yeah. The one other thing I want to address is that you just mentioned a lot of her friends knew bits and pieces. And that stands out to me because when my sister died, a lot of her friends knew bits and pieces. And I always think if everybody had been together, it would have become, you know, everybody would have put the piece of the puzzle together. And I feel that also for Susan, because Josh was so controlling, did he control who Susan could and could not see? Meaning, do you think he controlled her staying away from large groups of friends where all of you could get together and see them in a group? Or did he control the group size and who she couldn't see and keep it in small settings?
As far as I know, I don't think he did control who she saw. I think that was probably one of the only things he didn't control, because she had Wednesdays on her day off. And on those days, as far as I know, she was free to call or visit or talk with whoever she wanted to. She just had all these different friends in different settings. She had work friends, and she had neighbors that were her friends, and she had church friends, and some of those people didn't know each other at all. And so it wouldn't have been very natural to get a party with her work friends and her church friends together.
What do you think happened to Susan?
I think he was going to dump her by her work and make it look like she'd been mugged on the way in and it was an accident. And I think that he was going to make her purse disappear, and so it would look like someone had stolen her stuff and, you know, killed her. And something happened to mess up his plans. I don't know what, but something happened, because I'm sure that he intended to take the boys to daycare and go to work on Monday.
You do think that?
Oh, I do. Yeah. Something happened to mess up his plans and make him be gone the entire day on Monday. I don't know what.
Do you think he poisoned her?
I do. Or at least sedated her, something to make her more easy to control.
Is there anything you want to add that I haven't asked you about?
So if you have a friend or a family member who is showing any of these signs, please do everything in your power to help them. Please help them with resources, with support, be a listening ear, pray for them, just everything you can. We can't force somebody to leave someone else. We can't force them to change, but we can sure show them options and be there and help them in every possible way. I have a dear friend who called me up a couple of weeks ago, and she was very upset. And she said, somebody that I'm very close to is with a very verbally and emotionally abusive husband. He manipulates and controls her. He doesn't let her see or talk to her family anymore. He's isolating her. What do I do? And I'm so afraid she's going to end up like Susan. And I gave her domestic violence resources, a hotline she could call. And it was so heartbreaking because I just know that we cannot force anyone to leave, but we can be there for them and help them as much as they will let us.
Yeah. Yeah. I know this has taken a toll on you over the years. In fact, now things in the news are, they think they possibly have finally found Susan's body. When you hear things like that, when this case just goes on and on and on because her body has never been found, do you just relive it all?
Yes. The recent search of a mine that was in the Utah desert was very, very public and got tons and tons of interest reawakened in Susan's case from across the world, actually. And they didn't find her. The bones were animal bones. The pants had male DNA on them. But they're interested in looking, and they're going to look some more places. But it just really, it was almost like flashbacks, just reliving all the feelings and the thoughts of those first few weeks, because I still miss her every single day. I wear a purple bracelet because purple was one of her favorite colors, and it's also the color for domestic violence. I wear a purple bracelet that says "Find Susan" on my wrist, and I never take it off. And I think about her every day, and I miss her every single day, and she's still gone. But as time has gone on, I've been able to put my family first again and make them a priority. And so when things like that happen, it does bring back all those old memories as if it had just barely happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, listen, you're so brave and courageous to share what you know about this story, because I know just doing it, you're reliving it, and you have the visions in your head and things like that. But you are educating others. And I think it's so important that we do that. And it is so important that we speak up. And just like you said, to encourage people to get the help that they need when we see the warning signs. Because just because we don't know of a violent act that somebody has committed in the past doesn't mean that they're not capable of it. And so all these signs of the control and the manipulation and the intimidation, those are definitely a path down the wrong road. And I think you were a wonderful friend to her. And I know you tried to help her in every way that you could. And God bless you for that.
Thank you. I really appreciate the chance to share her story, because she's still missing. We still need to find her. And I keep hoping and praying that somebody out there somewhere in the world is going to come across maybe a scrap of information on some obscure website that would lead us to something that Josh and his family may have done, or something out in the wilderness, and we'll be able to find her. And then also, I've had so many women write to me and tell me, your friend did not die for nothing. Because I read her story, because I listened to her story, my children and I are alive today. I would not be alive if I didn't hear the story and recognize the signs and get out in time. So that's something that I'm really passionate about, is sharing her story for those two reasons.
Yeah, that's awesome. And that is awesome, because I want to tell you, if that is a way to honor Susan, and that is a way to honor past victims, if we don't do something to change the path that we're on, if it's the wrong path, if the warning signs are there, we're not honoring the victims that have come before us. So, I mean, that's beautiful. And you should be so proud about that.
I think Susan would be very, very happy to know that even though her disappearance has caused so much tragedy and heartache, that she has helped so many people and saved so many lives.
Yes. And so have you. You're going to help people. And that's what we do. We help people with our tragedies. Otherwise, their women are just going to keep getting plucked.
Yep. There's so many Susans out there, and there's so many Joshes.
Yeah. Good point. Good point. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barb.
When Susan disappeared, Josh played a very limited role searching for Susan. In fact, shortly after, he moved back in with his father, along with his two boys. He lost custody of his two sons September 22, 2011, when Steve Powell was arrested on child pornography charges. On February 15, 2012, a social worker brought the boys by to see Josh at their home in Utah. He pushed the worker out of the house and set the house on fire, killing his two sons and himself. In February 2013, Josh's brother Michael jumped off a building, committing suicide. And his father, Stephen, he died of heart conditions in July 2018. Many people believe that these three men were the only ones that could lead detectives to Susan's body. But I'm a firm believer that if more than one person knows a secret, if more than two people know a secret, somebody out there knows what happened to Susan. If you have any information that can help detectives find Susan Powell's body, please report it to Crime Stoppers at 936-639-TIPS. That's T-I-P-S. And if you know anybody that is in a relationship with domestic abuse, please have them call 800-799-SAFE. That's 800-799-7233. The website for domestic violence is thehotline.org. One of the best things about the National Domestic Violence Hotline is they can help you with a plan to get out, to keep you safe as well as your children. In my next episode, if you know someone that's a loner, a 50-year-old that may still live with their mother, what are the warning signs when it comes to the exploitation of children? I'm your host, Barb Jordan. Thanks for joining me on another episode of Always Bev, The Ripple Effect.